The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
It was on regular rotation most weekends. I don't even know how many times I've seen Stand By Me, but it's been many.
The terrible Australian, B. Jemine.
And he pretty much just yells out, "Misery's alive, misery's alive. Oh, this whole house is going to be full of romance. Oh, I'm going to go put on some Liberace records." I don't know why that line just killed me for some reason.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
There's some serious shit going on, and here I'm like, the f***? What is this? Why?
Mature themes.
King himself and also Mick Garrison, how they sort of stage how this virus sort of spreads and everything, was just very eerie and very unsettling for me.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is B. Jemine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to the long-awaited 26th episode of the King Zone podcast, the podcast where we discuss the film and TV adaptations of the works of Stephen King. Apologies for this latest episode taking as long as it did, because I'm like looking back on when the previous King Zone podcast was, and that was back in July, so it has been quite a few months since the last one. But to be fair, though, Marcy and I have been very busy over the last few months with a whole bunch of stuff, so it has been taking a while to kind of sit down and do a King Zone podcast. However, though, our spin-off podcast, the King Zone Book Club, has had a few episodes since then, so at least that'll make up for, you know, the lack of the main show. Unfortunately, though, my regular co-host, Super Marcy, won't be here today, but she definitely sends her regards, and she'll be back again for the next episode of the show. However, though, I am joined by a very special guest who is part of the King Zone family, mainly because he has appeared on this show before, but he is also the co-host of our spin-off podcast, The King Zone Book Club, and that, of course, is Stephen T. Bolt. Hello, Stephen, how are you?
Hi, Bede. How are you going? That was a convoluted intro, man.
It was, but I'm blaming it because I recently had COVID, so I'm blaming it on that. That is my excuse for everything for the next few weeks, is just everything post-COVID.
Lean into it hard, man.
Indeed, indeed. But how have you been going, Steve? It has been a little while since we had you on this show, but of course you've been hosting the book club episodes of the show, but how's things been going with you, my friend?
Yeah, been good. It's been since The Stand, hasn't it?
That would have been over a year ago since The Stand episode, and that was like one of our most popular episodes we did that year.
Indeed. That's fantastic. Ooh. I've been doing good, man. You know, been busy, keeping busy, reading, doing whatnot, and trying to get my own thing going, working on the theater and et cetera. But as you mentioned, Marcy and I got a couple episodes of the King Zone Book Club podcast out in the last couple of months, and I've been nudging her as well. I'm like, come on, dude, we need, you know, it's been a little while. We need to get another one up. But I think we'll be until February before we hit one of those again.
Yeah, definitely. I like it. It's usually at this time of the year, it's always very difficult. But like I said, but for both Marcy and I, just the last few months in particular, probably from August onwards, it has been hectic for both of us for different reasons. Of course, so hence why there's been more Super Podcast episodes and To Be Tuesday episodes rather than just sort of the other shows we do. But I do promise to all of our listeners, we'll be back to our regular schedule program. And so we'll bring back Ozboycast, Podcasters of Horror as well. So we've got a lot of stuff we need to talk about. So I thought, you know what? We need to start the year off with with a King Zone episode. So we'll get straight to it. And for this episode of the show, we're going to be answering the call and talking about two. See what I did there? and doing two Stephen King film adaptations, which of course are the films Cell and Mr. Harrigan's Phone, which I'm trying to figure out what the connection between these two is, but I'm having a hard time figuring it out.
It took me a while. I finally put it together.
Indeed, indeed. They just have actors in them who have been in previous Stephen King
previous adaptations. Stephen King adaptations. That was exactly where I was going with that.
Indeed, indeed. But of course, though, We kind of paired these two together because they do deal with phones and cell phones and whatnot. So I think it was only made sense we put these two together for this episode. And I'm very excited to talk about these two films for different reasons. So, and I'm glad here, Steve, you're here to talk about these ones with me.
I'm happy to talk about this. We recently watched Mr. Harrigan's film, and I came away from that one just feeling so great about Stephen King adaptations. Really felt it was one of the better ones, which is the complete 180 that I had with Cell. So really, really looking to get into these with you, babe, and wondering what your take is as well.
Indeed, indeed. So we'll get straight to it and talk about our very first film, which of course is the 2016 sci-fi horror film Cell.
Hey, buddy.
Are you coming home?
Yeah. Soon. Gosh.
It's terrorists, right? It's gotta be terrorists.
Don't use your cell phone.
We're gonna survive. People are gonna die.
You okay?
They act for the good of the group as a whole. They may be the next stage in human evolution. What's happening now is more than temporary anarchy. It's the start of a war.
I want to wipe them out.
It's a suicide mission. You're gonna die.
I want to see my son. You okay?
Do not withhold your mercy from us, O Lord. For troubles without number surround us. May your love and your truth protect us. For here lies the dead, dust of the earth. Conquers evil. I believe that.
Are you coming home? Are you coming home? I just want you to come home.
Johnny's voice.
No, it's not.
I just
you know
to come
that
home.
Is not your son.
I just want you to come
Clay.
Home.
Clay, no!
Which was directed by Todd Williams, with a screenplay by Stephen King and Adam Elica, based on the novel of the same name by Stephen King. And this film stars John Cusack, Samuel L. Jackson, Isabel Furman, Owen Teague, and Stacey Keach. And the plot summary for this one, which I'm reading off IMDb, is a mysterious cell phone signal causes apocalyptic chaos. An artist is determined to reunite with his young son, in New England. Stephen, I know that you're a massive Stephen King fan, so, and I know you've read a lot of his books, so I have to ask, tell us your initial thoughts on the film adaptation of Cell, but also your thoughts on the book, well, if you've read it.
Oh, man, yeah, I did read this one. I think the book was 2006.
Took
a little while for the movie to get made, to get going. I think this is pretty much it's almost an excellent adaptation of a really, really bad book is the thing. I can't blame the director. I can't blame the screenwriters. I can't, you know, or at Adam Elica, at any rate. Steve gets all the blame on this one because it was just absolutely. I don't know. Ridiculous is too light a word. You know, it seemed to me, first of all, oh my God, our phones are turning us into zombies. That just seems too obvious a message to be being made here. You know, it didn't it didn't do anything new for the zombie genre at all. It brought nothing to it except, you know, how it got started, which is this mysterious pulse, right? Which, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, is there ever any answer as to where the pulse came from? What started that? What happened?
I'm not exactly sure, because, like, the weird part is, I have the book, Cell. That was actually the first Stephen King book I ever bought, and I never got around to reading it, so I'm hoping, even though from what a lot of people have told me, yourself included, has said that it's not a good book, but I'm hoping that at least it provides some answers compared to the movie adaptation.
No, man. No, don't hold on to hope for that, because I don't remember any of that from the book. I was hoping the movie might clear something up, like make something up. The movie has a different ending, slightly different ending. Some of the characters are a little, you know, different from who they were in the book. The girl, Alice, is quite different from who she was in the book. None of this really, you know, changes anything very much, you know, as far as the story goes. It's just that it felt to me like a lot like Under the Dome as well, which was this. I kept referring to that as I was reading it as The Stand Light. You know, there's always when I was researching for this piece, people were asking about Red Hoodie Man. People on Reddit were asking, is he Randy Flagg? Like, is he Randy Flagg? And that's what made me think, you know, I thought the same thing while I was reading the book. Not is he Randy Flagg, but this is the Flagg character. This is the one everybody's having the dreams about. But Red Hoodie Man, he goes nowhere and does nothing. Red Hoodie Man is not the one responsible for the pulse. He's in the movie, at any rate, if I remember, he's a character from Clay's graphic novel, right? Who just shows up in the world somehow. People start sketching him. They're having dreams about him. And he's just this guy in a red hoodie who really doesn't have anything to do with anything. It's shockingly underwhelming. I think really, really not, really just not very good as far as a plot device goes, you know, because if you're going to have someone like that, you're going to have a character like that, make him a character. But we never get inside Red Hoodie Man's head. We don't, he has no, like the whole thing is, you know, your antagonist is supposed to want exactly what the hero wants for the opposite reasons. Right? This works all through cinema, all through literature, all through everything ever. And here we've just got a guy in a red hoodie that people are dreaming about. There's no real bad guy quality to him. It's weird, man. It's really weird. And this is the same as in the book, too. So it's not just the movie that does this. Like I said, I think the movie is a fairly good adaptation of the book. It's just a shame, you know, it wasn't a great book.
Yeah, well, as I stated before, I've only ever just seen this movie. I haven't read the book, even though I do have it. As a movie on its own, I was always very curious because I'd heard about this, you know, when I bought the book at the time, it had this kind of like, I don't know if it was like one of Stephen King's, like he hadn't written anything in maybe a little bit, so it was like his first novel in a little while. And also, it was his first zombie-related book, so... And I was getting into the zombie genre a lot at the time. And of course, like, this was, like, before, like, when zombies became huge, like, a few years later, after when, you know, the Walking Dead TV show and other zombie films came out. So I guess Stephen King was kind of getting in there before all that stuff was happening, and also adding the sort of technological aspect of having it be centered around cell phones. Because, you know, this is around the time in the mid-2000s where iPhones were starting to come out and also other phones and all that. We're starting to get very obsessive about phones. So Stephen King found an opportunity to kind of dive into that while putting this type of theme into a zombie story. So I was very curious about that. And also the book cover itself is actually very eye-catching, the original
book cover. The book cover's great. Yeah, the book cover's
great. It's a really good book cover. And I heard like that they'd been working on a film adaptation for a little while now, for a long time. Eli Roth was attached to direct it with the writers of like Ed Wood and Dolomite Is My Name writing the script. So I was very curious, and then it kind of just went by the wayside. And then, of course, once I heard a new film adaptation was coming out, and Todd Williams, who directed a couple of indie films I had seen, like Door on the Floor, and he also directed Paranormal Activity 2 as well. So he's got a little bit of horror cred under his belt. And Stephen King himself adapting the film as well. And of course, you got John Cusack, Samuel L. Jackson, reuniting on another Stephen King adaptation after what they did with 1408. So I was kind of curious to see how this film was, because I was actually legit excited for it, because, you know, Stephen King doing a zombie story. I'm excited. Within the first 5 minutes of this film, I got to say, I was like, what is going on? And I was like that throughout the rest of the 90-minute runtime of this film. I was like, what? What's going on? And I think the reason for that is because at this point, because this movie, I think they started shooting it in 2013. So it was on the shelf for a little while before it finally got released. I think by this point when the film was released, like, we were already oversaturated with zombie stuff, mm-hmm. a lot of films mm-hmm. and TV shows. So by the time when, I guess when the book came out, which felt like a fresh take on the zombie genre, when the film adaptation came out, by this point, it's kind of like something like John Carter of Mars or something like that, where it's like, it's way before everything else, but then once it came out, it feels very derivative of everything yes. else.
Yeah, yeah.
But the only distinct difference being that, of course, it has the cell phone stuff with this phone signal that turns people into sort of ravenous, crazy zombies. But also they have different characteristics. Like, they almost act like flocks of birds when they are hanging out with each other. They make noise sounds with their mouths.
And where does that come from, can I ask? I mean, I get, okay, all right, this pulse sort of, you know, fries their brains, whatever, turns them into ravenous zombies. Got it. I can even almost understand them, you know, turning into a flock, that they've got a hive mentality. Like, I can, yeah. I can go with that. When did they become transmitters? No, come on. I don't get that part. Like, I really don't. I think that's one I can suspend disbelief with the best of them, seriously. But that's just like, oh, that's one too far. That's just one too far, you know, because they're using it now like it felt like Donald Sutherland at the end of Invasion of the Body Snatchers, right? When he just opens and starts howling at Veronica Cartwright. Like, that's what these guys were felt like they were doing. It's I don't know. There's so much about it. Like I said, it all goes back to the book. And I'm not one to slam Stephen King, because he doesn't call me and ask me, you know, to edit the material. Do you know what I mean? Like, this, Steve's going to write what he wants to write. He's there, right? But this one just seemed like he's trying to make a social commentary, and that social commentary is, as you say, in the first 5 minutes. And then after that, when the phones turn everyone into zombies, what are you going to do with it? You know, what are you going to do with it after that? And there wasn't a lot of story left after that. It was just like, oh, we have to get to the tower. We have to shut down the tower. And to what end? Everybody's still a zombie. Everybody's still, you know.
But you know what, Abby, you were right before in sense with this film, that maybe it's because, like, I watched this like 5 years ago when it came out. But now, having seen both versions of The Stand, which, you know, we did a podcast on, watching this, I'm like, so this is kind of just like a small scale version of The Stand, like mm-hmm. a tiny little version of it, because there are a lot of motifs from The Stand in this film. Like you say, the Raggedy Man, that's what the character they call in the film, who is, again, kind of like this Randall Flagg-esque character who barely does anything in the film. And of course, you know, they dream about him, and they need to go to this location to... and all that. So a lot of those things that Stephen King did with the Stand story are also prevalent in this film. So I just kept picking all those Stand references up.
Yeah.
And even make it even more so is that Owen Teague, who played Harold in the Stand miniseries, and this is a young Owen Teague as well, is also in this movie as well.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the son, isn't he? He's the kid.
Yeah, one of the kids at the boarding school that Stacey Keacher runs. So, yeah, that's and right. he goes on the adventure with the other characters. But also, like, like I said before, like at this point when this film came out, there was already so many zombie films and TV shows. Like visually, like I'll give the film a little credit, but I do like at times it kind of goes for almost like a gritty kind of doco kind of feel. But it feels derivative or visually and also how things happen of other zombie films that we'd already seen at that point. So even though, yeah, it has the weird phone signal thing, but outside of that, it's just no different from any other zombie film that would already was released at the time.
No, it's a greatest hits. It's a greatest hits. It doesn't bring anything new to the genre apart from the phone thing, which, I mean, Shaun of the Dead did that in the opening credits sequence. You know, like the same thing. And what are you going to do with it afterwards? That's the thing. And really, he did nothing. He did nothing. I was very, I don't want to say I was very upset. I did not have high expectations and they were not met.
Yeah, this one is like, there's so much to say about this film. Like, I guess the key thing that would have brought a lot of people to go check it out is, of course, John Cusack and Samuel Jackson reuniting on another Stephen King adaptation. Because I really enjoyed 1408, and I thought that was a really good take on Stephen King's story. And so I was kind of just excited, like, oh, they're back together for a second one. I mean, as hard as they try with their performances, they're not really given much to do. And John Cusack's character also felt like a greatest hits of other performances he has done as well. And I had to laugh because this is the period in John Cusack's career where, for some reason, I don't know why he was doing this, he kind of went down the whole route by starring in direct-to-video movies.
Oh, yeah.
Especially action films. And I honestly don't know, get why that was, but, and to me, Cell, it kind of felt like that, because this is like, I like John Cusack as an actor. I would say I'm a fan of his work, and he does the best he can with this character, but he just doesn't seem like he was all in on the performance, even though he's an executive producer on this film, but it felt like he was kind of a bit bored by the material, And I guess, and also, he kind of wears the exact same thing he wears in every film at that time. He was like, I always joke, you can tell what type of period of film John Cusack is in if he's wearing a hat on the poster. It's either a beanie or a hat because he wears it all the time. And from what I read, when he goes up to his films, he has his own wardrobe. He just rocks up in his own clothes.
Oh, okay.
So I would not be surprised if he did that with this film as well.
That's funny. Oh my god. Yeah, I don't know, man. I like Cusack too. I am a fan. I absolutely adore Gross Point Blank. I think that's one of my go-to movies. That's one of my go-to feel-good movies. I do dig that one. I don't know what he was trying to do around this period. It came later, but Frozen Ground? Have you seen Frozen Ground?
I still haven't seen Frozen Ground, but I should have by now because it has my man Nick Cage in it.
Well, I was going to say that too, you know. And it's both of them playing against type. Cage keeps it at about, you know, he never goes full Cage, right? He never goes full Cage. And John Cusack is playing a serial killer. So I do think there was this point in his career where, I mean, even in Gross Point Blank, sure, he's playing a hitman, but he's likable. Yeah, he's a good guy, you know. He wanted to break away. He wanted to go against type with some of these roles, and I don't know. I think he has one. It's not that he has one speed. He sort of has one speed that he's really good at, and the other speeds are like, okay, John, you got that out of your system now. Come on back, buddy. Come on, let's do something we're all going to enjoy.
You know? And also, like, the character he plays is kind of similar to the one he played in 1408. Because he's also a family man who also, unlike in that film where he's like this novelist who's also makes his mission to debunk paranormal activity, he is a graphic novelist in this version.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of not really that much of a stretch in terms of like who he plays in this film.
Greetings, gentlemen. Miss, welcome to Gaydon Academy.
If you folks need a place to stay for the night, we have plenty of rooms. The boys who didn't have cell phones have all run off. The ones who did have them,
well, we know about them.
I'm Jordan. I'm a scholarship boy. I lived in Holloway.
Good for you, Jordan.
Yes, sir. That's what the head said, too.
Charles Adai, headmaster. Quite a problem these cell phones have caused now, isn't it?
Huh.
The devil's intercom is what I used to call them.
Nice. Tapped.
What's with the music?
Did you ever play musical chairs as a child?
Yeah.
Well, as long as the music doesn't stop, we've got nothing to worry about. We'll have a quick peek, then we'll go over to Cheatham Lodge for dinner. It's not 200 yards from Tunney Field, I promise.
Holy shit. Is the music coming from their phones?
Don't worry, they won't wake up.
How can you be so sure of that?
Observe.
What the hell are you doing? Is
he... No, be still, be still. I could put my sword cane right through his throat and he wouldn't try to stop me. Nor would those around him spring to his defense. Of course, if I tried it in the daylight, they'd tear me limb from limb.
The music comes from their mouths, too. It's not hardly a whisper, but you can hear it.
Come here. See, that's gotta be your imagination. There's no way that they're actually talking.
Come listen.
I can hear it.
How's that even possible without a transmitter?
They are transmitting. It's a new skill they seem to have picked up. And they're changing at an alarming rate.
Can we please move this conversation inside? Please?
No, I that hadn't occurred to me actually when I saw it. But I don't know. This one, I give this one a pass just because I think you're right. It was on the shelf for 3 years. They kind of knew they didn't have a great movie here. You know, they had to know that. I don't count even the poster, man. Have you seen the poster? It's this horrible Photoshop job. It's just
The posters and don't do this film any favors either.
No, it's like nobody had any faith in this, and it almost seems like that was from conception. You know, because as you say, nobody's really bringing. I was absolutely thrilled to see Stacy Keach in this. Absolutely thrilled. I haven't seen Stacy Keach in anything for years. And then he turns up in this, and he turns up in Truth a couple of years following. And I absolutely love that guy from the 1980s Mike Hammer TV show. It was my first thing with him. But also, I'm a big fan of Road Games, Richard Franklin's Road Game, right? So love seeing Stacy Keach, but that did it for me. That was really the only time, you know, I really sat up and paid attention.
And also, like, basically his character is just there for exposition. And I love the exposition in this film because every time our main characters run into someone, they seem to also know everything that's going on as well.
That's true. That's true. Oh, my God.
Especially it's like, oh, they're like when they see all the zombies that are hanging out on the football oval, like they're all basically when it gets night, they basically shut down like they're all computers. And if you like get close to their mouths, you can hear music come out of their mouths. Now, I know Stephen King wasn't on drugs when he wrote this book it's based on, but are we sure he did not have at least one sniff before he started writing it?
This is mental, man. Can we at least blame the other screenwriter for some of this?
I think so, but even though I haven't read the book, like when I went on the Wikipedia page and read through the synopsis of it, it's like this is like you say, it's very close to the book for most part.
Yeah, it is. I like to think that like the first draft, King took a lot of the worse elements out of it, and the other guy just brought them right back. I can't lay all of this at Steve's feet. I'll tell you what, man. It's been so long since I've read the book, and I didn't even want to go back and read a synopsis to make a proper comparison. It was not a good time. It was not a good time reading that one. And I really I read that came out just after Lisi's story, which was wonderful. You know, Lisi's story was the book had it had ups and downs for me, but overall I just thought that was a beautiful book. And then we get Cell. And there was just no.
Well, I know Stephen King has said multiple times, and I think I did say this even on the episode when we did cover the miniseries version of Lisi's story, that that book is his personal favorite book that he has ever written.
Yeah,
or
And
so maybe it was like he wrote that and like, oh, shit, I better... that's kind of more of a sort of a dramatic book. Maybe I need to, like, you know, quickly write out a horror book so I can keep the fans happy.
One for me, one for them. One for me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case. And there's other things about the film that, you know, you got Samuel L. Jackson. This is a very low-key Samuel L. Jackson performance. Yeah. And I think it's interesting, too, because in the book, from what I've read, the character he plays of Tom is actually white in the book, and then the Raggedy Man was black, but they've race swapped the characters.
Yeah, yeah, that's so, right.
Yeah, so I think Samuel L. Jackson does a decent job. Like, it's hard for me to hate Samuel L. Jackson in anything. but I would say if any of the performances kind of stood out for me, I would have to say Isabel Furman was probably gave the best performance in the film. I actually really liked her character a lot, and then, you know, granted, this is a spoiler podcast, so I'm going to say this anyway. when her character dies, because I completely forgot her character dies at the end of the second act, I was actually kind of completely sad, and especially because how she dies is a pretty realistic death, because one of the phoners, that's what they call them in this film.
Phoners, yeah. Forgot about
that. Just call them zombies.
Like,
just call
them zombies. Let's just find any word where we don't have to call them zombies. Do you think in a real life scenario, Bede, we would, you know, if this shit happened, we would not just automatically refer to them as zombies? We would have to say, no, they're not eating brains. We have to we have to come up with something else.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's but I know they called them zombies earlier in the film, but it's almost like it's almost like a Shaun of the Dead kind of situation. It's like, don't be ridiculous. They're not zombies.
Don't be ridiculous. We don't use the Z word.
We're going to use the P word. We're going to call them phoners instead.
You were talking about her death, and I went off on a tangent.
I had to go into that because I thought, phoners, really? You could think of a better name than that. But her death is actually quite tragic because she gets hit over the head by a zombie, and realistically, when they show her, she's like, obviously has a very bad concussion. Her eye is hemorrhaging. Like, which looks very realistic, and she's just basically gone incoherent, and she dies in John Cusack's arms. And I actually felt really sad for her character, because her character goes for a lot in the film, and I think out of all the performances, that was definitely the one that kind of affected me the most, because out of everyone, like, even though everyone is trying, I don't think there is a bad performance in this film, but compared to everybody else, she was, like, the one that seemed the most committed to her role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she Alice was her name, right? Alice.
Yeah.
Alice, if I remember, was a bit of a goth punk rock chick in the movie. She was really quite wholesome in the book, which was again a change that didn't really make any difference. But she had the same death, and it took forever in the book. Forever for her to die, and it was really, really difficult to get through, because you cared about her, you cared so much about her, and I agree, as in the movie, in the book, she was the one that we really cared something about, because obviously, you know, Clay, he's either gets to his family or he doesn't. Tom is either going to be with him or he's not. But, you know, Clay is the hero. Everyone else is just collateral. And you kind of hoped Alice would be the one to make it to the end with him. And when she didn't, it was really pulled the rug out. I thought she was going to make it, and then she didn't. So in the movie, when that finally came around, I was prepared for that. And, like, thank God, it didn't take... In the book, I swear it took two chapters for her to die. It was really, really hard. Really hard. She did a great job, Isabel Furman. Really, really good.
Oh, yeah. And I think also when you kind of see, and it's just a little, that the detail of her eye hemorrhaging, like, you see, compared to the other one, like, her eye is just slowly getting more and more red. I just saw that. And for some reason, that just gave me chills, just seeing that eye, because again, it looks incredibly realistic.
Yeah, that like, was very good. Do you know who did the effects on that?
I'm not sure who did the effects, but I just know that it's kind of a subversive thing in this film, because if you ever see a film or a horror film or a different one, when someone gets clobbered over the head really hard, usually in the next scene, then just like shrug it off and they're fine. But the fact that it's like a realistic what would happen if someone got really banged over the head really hard, like depending which area you're in, it could easily kill you.
Or they'll have a really bad prosthesis.
Yeah, exactly. Like
that, you know, I just looked it up. Dude, it was KNB. Of course it was KNB.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Of course it would be KNB. So, but then also we get to the last half, because basically Clay goes to find his wife and son. He finds out that his son's not there. His wife has now been turned into a phoner. I just can't help but laugh every time I just say phoner.
Phoner. Oh, God.
So he decides, he tells the others, like Tom and all that, because they run into a couple other characters as well. I keep forgetting the names of the guy and girl who they run into, but this guy is like, has not slept in over a week. He is absolutely manic, and he says, like, he has a lot of C4 in his truck, and he plans to go to the site where...
Ray.
Yeah, Ray, that's it. Mm-hmm. To go to the site where all the phoners are and the Raggedy Man is, and just blow everything up. So Clay decides to go do that. And I know from what you said it before, but also what I've read as well, is that Stephen King changed the ending of the book, because apparently, like, readers hated the ending of the book. I'm surprised that's the only part that he listened to. So Clay gets there, finds his son, but his son is now basically has turned into a phoner himself. He tries to kill the Raggedy Man, but the dude just can't die.
Why? And,
yeah, and I guess that's the thing. Like, if he kind of did maybe a rewrite and maybe said, like, oh, this is maybe a character based on Randall Flagg or, like, a different character or something like that, trying to do... take over this part of the Stephen King multiverse, I could get that. But the fact that, at least in this film version, that character is never explained, like, what his motivations is or why he's doing it or what the point of the phoners is, it's very confusing. And then, of course, like Clay makes the ultimate sacrifice. He blows himself up and the Raggedy Man and all the other phoners. But then the movie decides to give him... an unnecessarily bleak ending is like, oh, it's all a hallucination, and now Clay has now become a phoner, and he's running around the tower, which even then I'm like reminded, oh, is that meant to be kind of like symbolic of, say, the Dark Tower or something like that?
Oh, my God, yeah. Look, I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, absolutely. It's another tower reference, isn't it? An unnecessarily bleak. I love how in your vision, him blowing himself up wasn't bleak enough, but him getting to the tower.
Well, to be fair, what I mean by that is, like, he takes out the bad guys and everybody wins in the end.
He's got a heroic death, right?
And then, you know, and Tom and the other survivors head off to Canada, because that's the thing, like, the Raggedy Man is. He's kind of doing the opposite of something like Mother Abigail. Like, he's getting in people's dreams to, like, come to this electrical tower and stuff like that. And everyone thinks, oh, that's where safety is. There's no power lines, nothing like that. But it's all basically a trap to turn more people into phoners. Like, at least that's what I gathered from the film.
And to what end? Like, that, you know, haha, now you've come to the tower, now you're a phoner, and now we just wander aimlessly forever and ever and ever. It's so bizarre, man, because again, there doesn't seem to be any purpose to it. The ending of the book that you said that people hated, I am shocked that, you know, the ending is the part that they hated. But you know, when Clay, he gets to his son, he does manage to turn off the transmitter. People seem to be going back to normal, and he's sort of just waiting with his son. Like, it ends almost the way if people read The Mist, it ends with an ambiguous ending, as opposed to the movie, which has a very, very definitive ending, The Mist. it's sort of an open-ended, you know, will Johnny come back? Will he not? We just don't know. And it's left there. But the movie goes, no, no, we're going to give him a heroic death. We're going to blow everything up. But then, wait for it. No, it was all a dream, right? To no real end, to no real purpose. He's got this, you know, he's wandering around having this memory of himself being a hero, I guess. But the idea being he's now with his son, which is supposed to be this, I guess, sort of heartwarming, be careful what you wish for, monkey's paw ending. He's with his son, but they're both phoners. So
yeah, Yeah, that's the thing. You could either interpret it as basically when they're walking along that, you know, railway track. I get another motif of Stephen King's work. And I just want to remember, this film's actually the third Stephen King adaptation Cusack has been in, because he was also in Stand By Me as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I was about to say The Stand, and that's a completely different adaptation altogether. But you never know. It's like, is that the afterlife that they're in? Or is it all just a hallucination in his mind just to keep him as a phoner working? Like, you can interpret that in two different ways, but yeah, I'm just like thinking, like, I don't really like this ending. Does not work for me, this ending.
I'm all for ambiguous endings, but man, I don't want to have to work this hard. I really don't.
And we never even find out what happened to Tom or the others. Like, we see them last at the house, and then after that, we never see them again, or whether they've made it or anything like that.
There's no closure. No closure.
No closure. And also, John Cusack has a thing about blowing things up in Stephen King adaptations, because I believe he did the exact same thing in 1408 as well.
Oh my God, this gets worse the more we talk about it.
But one thing I'll say about this film before we wrap out our conversation on Cell is that one thing that made me pop this film in the first 5 minutes, like, when basically, like, Clay is at the airport, shit goes down, everybody's either who's on their phone becomes a zombie, starts attacking people. There are some effective moments in there, like, especially when, like, a character is being stabbed, but even then, it's shot so erratically, like, it just becomes off more annoying than effective. For bizarre reason, maybe it's because he was a special guest on an episode of the 2B Tuesdays podcast earlier this year. Out of nowhere, Lloyd Kaufman appears as a bystander near John Cusack, and I looked, I'm like, that's Uncle Lloyd.
I forgot he was in this. I totally forgot he was in this. Yeah. I had the same reaction. I'm like blinking. I'm going, was that Lloyd? To go back. Yeah.
Indeed. And so the movie gets at least an extra half star because of Uncle Lloyd being in this movie.
Fantastic. So it's got a half, it's got a full star now?
Exactly. Like, I would never expect Uncle Lloyd to be in a Stephen King adaptation.
Oh, God.
Not unless he has been in other ones that I'm not aware of. But
you know what, though? Doesn't that say it all about this? Isn't that really just the cherry on top? Is that, oh, okay, wait a minute. As soon as you see Lloyd Kaufman show up, you really ought to know what level of film you're
oh, in. Oh, yeah. Here,
you know?
Oh, yeah. I would be surprised he was just walking past the set one day and be like, hey, Lloyd, come and have a little quick scene in this movie.
You know what? That's totally not fair. I take that back. The dude was in Guardians of the Galaxy. He had kind of a starring role or a supporting role in The Final Countdown. You know, let's not lay all this at Lloyd's feet.
Yeah, exactly. Uncle Lloyd is a treasure, not because we had him on an episode of the 2B Tuesdays podcast where he did an audio commentary for one of his films with him. He gets a lot of love from me, and so he's a treasure in my eyes. But I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Cell. But so, Steve, tell us your final thoughts on the film and also your rating of the out of five.
Look, I've got a massive movie collection here at home, Beat, and I do have many of the Stephen King adaptations, good and bad. I've even got movies that I don't particularly like that are well loved by others. The Shining. So, like, I do not have Cell in my collection.
Not even on DVD.
Not even on DVD. Not even on friggin' VHS. Man, like, no. I won't have Cell in my collection. I've got to give it... Oh, baby. What can I give it? It gets half a star for Lloyd, half a star for Stacy Keach, man.
I was gonna say, because the last time you were on this show, you talked about, like, when we talked about the Stan miniseries, the new version, and that was basically like you have a lot of Stephen King of work on film on your collection, and that was the one you're probably never gonna get.
Yeah.
And I was sort of wondering, I wonder where Cell falls on that scale.
Where do I draw the line, man? I'm not proud. I've got Silver Bullet. I will never watch Cell again, not even for, you know, ironic purposes, you know, because I watched Silver Bullet. It's not great, but it's fun. You know, Cell doesn't even have that going for it. Now I can't.
Well, I love Silver Bullet, but that's just me. But that's a whole different story altogether. But I think this will probably be the second and only time I'll watch Cell. Unless I have to do it for podcasting purposes and then rewatch it in press.
Sure, business purposes, absolutely.
Exactly. So if I had to give it a rating, I'd give it about a 1.5. Like, there are little elements in it that I did enjoy. And I, you know, like a big zombie fan like myself, like I will watch anything zombie related. And I think there are some interesting ideas in there that make it different from other ones. But I just don't feel like this film, and from what I hear, the book, don't really flesh it out in a way that feels interesting. It just, if anything, it kind of makes it feel very messy in terms of its approach, or it just underdevelops it. I think the cast do as well as they can with the film, but they're just not really given much to do. But Isabel Furman, like, I think is the best performance, so she gets kudos from me. And of course, you know, Lloyd Kaufman having a cameo in it as well. So, so 1.5 overall for me. But we'll move right along from Cell to take another call from somebody else's phone.
There we go.
Which we're going to talk about the recent Netflix original film that came out in 2022. And that, of course, is Mr. Harrigan's Phone.
You are a far different person now from who you were when we met.
Back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues.
Why do you continue to come here?
Because I enjoy our time together.
I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
iPhones just came out.
Thank you.
Let's give you a nickname. Pirate King. Wicked. Yeah.
I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Mr. Harrigan, has anyone ever tried to take advantage of you? How'd you deal with that?
Harshly.
Hey, Dad.
Hey, buddy. I've got some really bad news.
I will call you back if it seems appropriate.
Mr. Harrigan, I wish that you were here. I got beat up pretty bad at night. I want him to get what he deserves. He's a good man,
but you didn't want to be on his bad side.
If Mr. Harrigan had anything to do with anyone dying, that made me an accessory. Back to school,
ring the bell. It was a tragic accident, that's all.
My grandma always used to say, person shouldn't call out unless they want an answer.
Which was written and directed by John Lee Hancock, based on the novella Mr. Harrigan's Phone from the collection If It Bleeds by Stephen King. And this film stars Donald Sutherland, Jaden Martell, Joe Tippett, and Kirby Howe Baptiste. And the plot summary for this one, which once again I am reading off IMDb, is: when Mr. Harrigan dies, Craig, the teen who befriended and did odd jobs for him, puts his smartphone in his pocket before burial. When the lonely youth sends his dead friend a message, he is shocked to get a returned text. This is definitely one of Stephen King's most recent works because, like I said, it's from his If It Bleeds collection. And from what I understand, two other stories from that are also in the works of being made into films, one by Darren Aronofsky and the other by Ben Stiller. The other one, I believe they were trying to possibly make into the second season of the show The Outsider until that got cancelled. But to me, honestly, I always found that to be more of a miniseries more than anything. It didn't need to have a second season, but that's just me. So I was kind of curious to sit down and watch Mr. Harrigan's Phone because the plot sounded interesting. And like Cell, it also features actors who have previously appeared in other Stephen King works, like Jaden Martell, who was in the It films, Donald Sutherland being in the Salem's Lot miniseries from the early 2000s. So I was kind of curious. And also John Lee Hancock, who has had quite a bizarre career, because this guy has made films such as The Blind Side, Saving Mr. Banks, The Highwaymen, and most recently Little Things. So he's kind of all over the place with his film work. And also Ryan Murphy and Jason Blum also produced this film together as well. So I was kind of curious, like, all these people working on this film. Now, Steve, what are your thoughts on the film Mr. Harrigan's Phone, but also have you read the novella that it's based on?
Well, I have. If It Bleeds was 2 years, 2 years ago?
I think it was 2 years ago, yeah.
Yeah. Really enjoyed the story. Really, really enjoyed the story. I thought it was I don't want to say it's one of his best stories. It's the type of story he does best is what I mean, right? It's a ghost story, kind of, but it's not about the ghosts. It's about the haunty more than the haunted, which is fantastic. I think Jaden Martell does a great job here. I wasn't sold on him in It. Again, full disclosure, big fan of the original miniseries, so nothing is ever going to touch that for me, you know. But I thought this movie was as close to great Stephen King as you can get. Great Stephen King being stuff like Shawshank Redemption, Stand By Me, ironically, the stuff that's, you know, not horror, which is mostly what people want from him. He does better when he's dealing with characters. And in a movie like Shawshank or Stand By Me, where there is no horror, the focus is the characters. But when something comes along that is horror, the filmmakers will tend to focus on the horror rather than the characters, right? And in this is the perfect mix of this, because there's so much story going on before any horror even is introduced that you're well grounded in that genre already. And when the horror elements, I'll stop saying horror, but like the haunting element comes into it, it just feels like a natural part of this story. It's fantastic. I love this. I absolutely love this one. It's not one of my favorite King movies, but it's definitely one of the better adaptations out there.
You know what? I have to say, because I wasn't sure what to expect from Mr. Harrigan's Phone. So I just assumed, okay, based on the premise, definitely going to be a horror story. And it is, but it is a mixture of so many different things. Like, it is a coming-of-age story. It's a drama. And I would say it's more supernatural than straight-up horror. Because, and also, even then, like, the supernatural elements are also kind of ambiguous a little bit as well. Like, you're never really sure, like, is Mr. Harrigan contacting Craig from beyond the grave? Or is it kind of just coincidences, like, and stuff like that?
Yeah.
And also, like, I was pretty much hooked from the very beginning. And even though I haven't read the original short story that it's based on, I automatically kind of knew watching it. It's like, oh, even though I haven't read the short story, This feels like it's the short's base.
Thank you. I appreciate the sentiment. But no. I suggest you give this to your father.
You told me you'd say that.
A wise man, he. Henry David Thoreau said, "We don't own things. Things own us." I don't have a television. Because if I did, I would spend my time watching it. I have a radio in the car, but I don't have a radio in the house, even though I like a bit of country and western from time to time. And if I had that, I would waste more time.
Basically, word for word of the story on the screen.
You all right?
No, there's something troubling me. Maybe you can explain it. I've been reading articles on this phone for a month now. And they've all been free.
Yeah?
No, I'm reading something for free that people pay good money for.
It's great, right?
No, it's not. Giving information away runs counter to everything I understand about successful business practices. The World Wide Web is like a broken water main. But instead of water, it's spewing information every which way. I don't understand. Is it a come on or what? I'm asking, Craig.
Kind of like the Freiburg Fair, where the first game is usually free.
Gee. And we're still on the first game, Freiburg Fair. And there are no advertisements on these sites. Ads are the lifeblood of newspapers. How will they survive? I don't think this is a come on. I think it's a gateway drug. I've already noticed that my Google search responses are on the side of financial information. It knows what I want. And what's going to happen when they close the water main? No more freebies. Oh, and false information becomes common and accepted as true. And what happens when they start using this to spread more nonsense than is already out there? Newspapers, journals, politicians, all of us need to be very frightened by this gizmo.
Because it felt like a very direct adaptation. We've covered so many different film adaptations of King's work on this podcast, and we can obviously tell, like, you know, some things are definitely, yes, King, but also some things that, you know, the filmmakers added in there as well. But this one kind of felt very directly adapted from the work, like, without barely any changes, or at least that any that I have read in research on the film. So from beginning to end, I was very much hooked. And I think, I really like the It movies myself, the newer ones. I mean, I do have a soft spot for the original miniseries, but I know that I love Tim Curry in it, but everything else is so dated as fuck.
Yeah.
But that being said, though, I think James Martell in those films and also here is also good. And it's also a different type of character as well. And I think he does really well, like, because he's got this entire film on his shoulders. And he's a very talented young actor, and I think he does a great job as Craig. But I also do love the relationship that we have between him and Mr. Harrigan, played by Donald Sutherland. Like, even though Donald Sutherland's only in the film for the first 40 minutes until his character dies, you really do feel that connection between the two of them. I just think they do such a great job. Also, once he dies and all these kind of weird supernatural things happen, like, as Mr. Harrigan says, like, you know, basically, if anyone does you wrong, smite your enemies and stuff like that. And again, I'm paraphrasing his dialogue from the film. So at first, you know, he kind of brushes that off because we kind of learn a little bit about Mr. Harrigan, like he was a ruthless businessman who has no family, no friends and stuff like that. As the film progresses, like the people that have kind of wronged Craig in his life, they kind of die in mysterious circumstances, whether it be like accidents, suicides, and all this happened when he like either calls Mr. Harrigan on his phone, like leaves a message and stuff like that. So it's kind of interesting. And again, like I said before, it kind of leaves it ambiguous about whether Mr. Harrigan is directly involved with these accidents or is it just a massive coincidence.
I like that aspect as well, I've got to say. Once the coincidences start, you know, piling up, you've got to go, well, okay, this is just too much. But you're right. Except for the third act, which I'll talk about in a little bit, everything that happens when Craig is talking to the late Mr. Harrigan on his phone, and then, well, as you say, it's a spoiler podcast, and then of course his bully is mysteriously Cyrus is mysteriously dead. You know, it's like, wow, okay, that could be a coincidence here, like, because you don't immediately jump to the conclusion that, you know, a ghost came back from the grave to you know, avenge you. This kind of leaves that, it strongly suggests that it was Mr. Harrigan, but it does open the door to, look, maybe this was just, maybe the messages that Craig is getting are just a glitch in the tower. You know, it's nothing to do with Mr. Harrigan. We don't know. But it's suggested, but not really they don't give it a lot of weight, I guess, is what I'm saying. Because as you say, it is a supernatural story. So that's the way your mind goes eventually.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think that's kind of the thing I really enjoyed the most about it as well, is like, it has that ambiguous feel, but at the same time, it plays everything just so low-key. Even the bully, Kenny, played by Cyrus Arnold, like, he's definitely one of the more effective bullies, because he doesn't play that character over the top at all, and he feels like a very believable bully, even though he looks like he's at least 40 years old in this film.
That kid was so good. He was so good.
He was really good, and I don't know why, he kept giving me, like, actually, he's 19 years old, so...
Yeah,
he is what we call in on the To Be Tuesdays podcast a hard Canadian 30.
I shouldn't make fun of him
because, like, he just looks a lot older than he did in the film, so I'm kind of legit shocked he's only 19 years old.
I thought he was so good. King bullies tend to be way over the top. Like, they've dialed it right up to, you know, beyond 11. They're at like a 17 or an 18. You know, if you look at Ace Merrill and his gang in Stand By Me, or
even like Henry Bowers in Henry It, or even one of our favorite bullies we love to talk about on this show, the main bully from Sometimes They Come Back, whose name I'm forgetting at the moment.
Oh, I haven't seen that in ages. But yes, exactly this. You know, Bowers is who I was thinking of specifically. They're, you know, you're 13 years old. Are you really going to stick this kid with a, you know, with a switchblade? Really? That just doesn't come right. And Kenny Yankovic played it, I don't know, well, I say Cyrus Arnold played Kenny Yankovic as though he didn't have a choice in the matter. He felt pained to be bullying young Craig, which I thought was a really interesting way to play it. Really interesting way to play it. So I was on board with him. I thought he did a great job. He was the young Derek Zoolander Jr. too.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Yeah, Zoolander 2. Don't see it if you haven't, because it'll ruin your love for the first one. But he was young Derek Jr. in that one, and I thought he was great. You know, Miss Hart was Kirby Howell Baptiste, who I know from The Good Place. She, if memory serves, she was not in the book or did not play as big a part in the book. So the third act of the movie, the story ends after Kenny's death. And Craig just going, well, I don't know what happened. I guess, you know, but to end the movie there's almost no third act. So with Ms. Hart and her fate and everything that happens there is where Craig gets more sort of proof that it is in fact Mr. Harrigan doing this stuff for him, which I thought, again, really just nailed it home and took away any sort of, this might be a coincidence sort of thinking. And I thought that was a great thing to do in the movie, you know, to extend it just that one proof more for Craig, because he was conflicted, but then the conflict was just taken away. He knew what was going on. He knew what he had to do. So I thought it was fantastic.
Oh yeah, for sure. Like, I think,
oh, wait a minute. I'm going to retract that. I'm going to retract that meme. It's been a while since I read this. I'm looking this up on Wiki right now, and actually the synopsis of the book does say, after a drunk driver is responsible for a beloved teacher's death, blah blah blah. So she was in the book. I take it all back. Forget everything I said about that not being in the story, man. That's wow, that's embarrassing as hell.
Don't worry, Steve. Like, this happens to me at least once or twice, or maybe five times per episode on any show. So
I've got,
it's, you know, okay.
I've got chapters of The Stand memorized. I really feel like I should have remembered the third act of this story.
But don't worry. It should be fine. I think our audience will forgive you for that.
Forgiving people? Okay, great. Good. Thank you.
One of the things, like, again, with sort of the ambiguity of this film is, like, once we get sort of to the ending of the film where, like, pretty much one of the big key things about Craig's character is that he's only ever since his mum passed away when he was young, he's only ever gone to see her grave once. So it's always, like, in a way, like, Mr. Harrigan's, like, almost, whether it is just him just playing in his mind or his ghost directly, kind of him to kind of accept and fully comprehend the death of his mother. And also, like, Craig also comes to the realization that the messages he's getting from Mr. Harrigan, or he thinks he's getting, are actually Mr. Harrigan basically telling him to move on from him and live his life. Don't get held up by grief and sadness. Move on and live your life, not just for him, but also his mother as well. And this is, like, stuff he's kind of realizing himself. So again, whether it is Mr. Harrigan directly from beyond the grave kind of doing this for him, or it could also just him kind of thinking about it a little bit or interpreting what those messages were, while also the accidents that he thinks Mr. Harrigan was involved in may have just been just accidents, nothing else, or suicide. And they're the completely separate things of what is going on. And again, I think that's an interesting thing about this film, that you can interpret it in any of those ways.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really one of the better King stories, you know, really one of the better King stories. I love when he writes stuff like this. Trying to think of some other stories that I can get, cut this part out, because I'm talking to you right now. I'm trying to think of some other stories.
Oh, no, I'm keeping this all in. I'm keeping this all in, my friend.
I want to back this up, but I have nothing to back it up with. But I don't know, man. I really did dig this one. And again, as you said, from who's the director on this one?
Oh, John Lee Hancock.
John Lee Hancock. From John Lee Hancock, he is kind of, as you said, you know, he's kind of all over the board with what he's done. How is he going to handle a supernatural, you know, I don't know if you would even call it a thriller. This movie, it almost defies categorization at one point.
Oh yeah. I can imagine some people going into this film based on the marketing and stuff like that, thinking like it's going to be a straight up horror film and being kind of disappointed that it's more of a supernatural drama than anything else. But I think that's kind of the thing that really drew me in, because it wasn't just a straight up horror story. It has a lot of other elements going on to it. And also, like Stephen King does really well, is crafting a coming of age story, which he does exceptionally well every time.
Yeah. Yeah. Three people could go in to watch this movie expecting three different movies, and they'd all come out completely satisfied.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like in Cell, which we talked about before, Stephen King, or at least, I don't know whether it is the same in the story or not, or it could be just something that John Lee Hancock did with adapting the film, they really do hammer in a little bit of the sort of social commentary when it comes to phones. Because like I said, this film is set during the mid-2000s when iPhones were starting to come out. So pretty much every teen character we see at the high school is like literally on their phones,
yeah.
like they would be right now. I don't know if I lived through the 2000s. I don't know if teens around that time were on their phones as much, at least based on my personal experience, but it does feel like, you know, it really drives in like, oh, this new technology is around and we've now become obsessed with it.
Oh, you were one of the cool kids is what the movie posits. You were one of the cool kids if you had a phone.
Yeah, you were a cool kid if you had a phone.
There was a different social circle that you were part of here, and you could join if you had a phone. I do remember that. And Mr. Harrigan was spot on with his condemnation of the phone. He didn't want the phone at first. And then once he realized, oh, he could follow the stock market? Are you kidding me? This is great. But yeah, he nailed it as far as paywalls go. He saw that coming. So yeah, I mean, of course, that's all King's writing in 2020 hindsight. But yeah, as far as the social commentary, yeah, you're spot on as well.
Yeah, and also I was just about to bring up that same thing. It's like making Mr. Harrigan almost become like a soothsayer in a way. Like, oh, like, yes, we had this phone technology, but imagine the implications that could follow. And he even brings up like, Mr. Harrigan even predicted kind of fake news and stuff like that, yeah. or like the news cycle kind of having not instead of taking the time to kind of fully, you know, investigate stories to find out if they're actually 100% accurate. You can like write out a news story within 5 minutes of hearing something, even if it has a lot of holes and everything in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, I think it's also really well directed as well. Again, it's a very low key film. Like, it's not very showy in how it's in its filmmaking or the way it's shot. John Schwartzman, Oscar nominated cinematographer John Schwartzman, shot this film. And of course, he's the father of Jason Schwartzman. And I just really enjoyed this one a lot. Like, it definitely was a pleasant surprise because, again, one part of me was expecting a full-blown horror story, given the premise, but the fact that there was a lot more going on in it that really sort of I found even more compelling. And, of course, there are some of the Stephen King motifs there, of course, like Craig wants to be a writer. Who didn't see that coming?
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed this one a lot. I think, like, the bit about this is the fourth Netflix produced Stephen King adaptation, and I really enjoy, and I've actually quite enjoyed most of them for most part, and Gerald's Game being the best one still for me, but I think Mr. Harrigan's Phone is definitely a very strong film. Even though I haven't read the original short story itself, I feel like I kind of necessarily don't even need to now because it feels like the short story was on the screen.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. I don't know that you'll get a lot out of reading it a lot more than you would because you've seen it, so it's all there.
But I might still regardless anyway, so. but I guess that could be a wrap on this discussion of Mr. Harrigan's Phone. So Steve, what are your final thoughts on this film and also your rating for it out of 5?
Final thoughts, again, one of the better adaptations out there. It didn't take too many liberties, you know, as far as it kept the story and changed what needed to be changed to make it work as a film. Again, like I mentioned, the third act there. So I thought it was fantastic. I give this one a 4.
You know what? I think I'm going to give this one a 4 as well. I agree with pretty much everything you said. Like, it felt very, like, I found it very compelling. The performances are all strong. I kind of regret we didn't really sort of dive into Donald Sutherland's performance as well. And I thought he was terrific as Mr. Harrigan.
Yeah,
and again, like, there's a lot of interesting layers to that character because, again, he is a character who is obviously was a ruthless businessman that everyone disliked, but at the same time, you get a sense of loneliness to that character, and he wanted some kind of connection with people, hence his relationship with the character of Craig, and he really did care about him a lot. So I think he does a great job, and also Jaden Martell's great as well, but also a lot of the cast all do a really good job in their roles. And yeah, I think it's a really solid little movie. So I'm going to give it 4 out of 5 as well. And it's definitely one that I enjoyed it the first time I watched it, but I definitely appreciate it even more so on the second watch for the show. Yeah,
that so, track.
Exactly. But yeah, I guess that could be a wrap on this long-awaited new episode of the King Zone podcast. And thank you, Steve, for coming back on the show and filling in as my co-host for this one.
Oh, thanks again, man. Thanks for having me. This is great.
Yeah. And I look forward to when you and Marcy finally get together to do the next book club episode of the King Zone podcast. And I know at some point you guys have asked me if I wanted to come on and do an episode with you as well. So I look forward to doing that.
Yeah, we'll work that out, man. We'll find out which story you want to talk about. Give that a think. And
yeah, I'm pretty much down for anything. If you have any suggestions, I'm more than happy to take them and read them. So
okay, all right.
So,
great.
And also thank you to all of our listeners for listening to this episode of the show. Again, apologies for this episode coming a little bit longer in the tooth than it was previously, but I promise there'll be more episodes of this show in the future, along with more episodes of our other podcast. But before we head off today, Steve, where can people find you on the internet this week?
Oh gosh, I'm all over the place on the internet. No, that's not even true. I have very little internet footprint. I run a theater company. You can find me at thenacktheater.com. We've got some shows coming up in the next year, some good stuff coming up. I am also on Facebook. I am on Letterboxd, and my handle there is Fulcirama, if you want to check out what I've been watching.
Awesome. And if people want to find me personally, they can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BJamine or my Letterboxd account at letterboxd.com/BJamine. And of course, you can find all my work at supermarcy.com with all my reviews and columns. And of course, you can find everything, the King Zone podcast, on all podcast streaming services everywhere. So you'll be able to find the show through there, and as well as all the other podcasts that Marcy and I have on the Super Network, like the 2B Tuesdays podcast, Podcasters of Horror, and as well as the flagship show, the Super Podcast, and also the Ozboy cast. Can't forget that one. and you can find this also, the official Twitter account for the Super Network, at @SM_SuperNetwork on Twitter, if that's still around by the time this episode drops. also check out my solo podcast, which is Bede versus the Living Dead, which of course is the podcast where I dissect every remake, re-edit, homage, unofficial follow-up, spoof, and so much more to George A. Romero's 1968 horror classic Night of the Living Dead. I'm already 4 episodes into that show, so definitely give those episodes a listen. And they're also on all podcast streaming services everywhere as well. So thank you, everyone, once again, for joining this long-awaited new episode of the King Zone podcast. We hope you all enjoyed it. And stay tuned for the next episode very soon, which hopefully will be coming out within the next month. So we'll see you then, everybody. Bye.
When you walk through a storm, hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark. At the end of a stone, there's a golden sky and the sweet silver song of a lark. Walk on through the walk on, walk on.
appreciate the sentiment, but no. I suggest you give this to your father.
You told me you'd say that.
A wise man, he. Henry David Thoreau said, "We don't own things. Things own us." I don't have a television, because if I did, I would spend my time watching it. I have a radio in the car, but I don't have a radio in the house, even though I like a bit of country and western from time to time. And if I had that, I would waste more time.
The Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN.
Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised.
A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi. So just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show.
Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link surfshark.deals/supernetwork to take advantage of this amazing deal.
You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark do 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 do. Surfy shark do 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 do.
And now back to the show.